Get ready to join us on our latest journey. The Compass is the podcast that travels far and dives deep to help us find our way in a complex world. Welcome on board. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Death in Ice Valley is returning.
We've been trying to find answers to an unsolved mystery.
And now we're back with an update on the case.
We'll be here to tell you more about it at the end of this podcast.
Hi, Peter Shevlin here, and you're listening to The Compass on the BBC World Service. We're travelling around the world listening to people living along the New Silk Road, or the Belt and Road Initiative, launched by China's President Xi Jinping. You may not have heard of the Belt and Road Initiative, but I have this one take-home for you. It is simply the biggest building project that there has ever been. It encompasses roads, rail, ports, connectivity, and potentially it's right there on your doorstep.
There are so many Chinese coming in, so many Chinese investments, so many high-rise buildings.
It's a huge scale that I have never seen before.
There are those who criticize what the Chinese do in Kenya.
They call it debt trap diplomacy.
The countries will eventually be unable to pay back those loans.
Everyone is heading to the end of the line,
the last stop before China.
This week we are ending our trip in China's western provinces. Hundreds of years ago, this is where the original Silk Road started. Today, massive infrastructure programs seek to make it a trading hub of the 21st century, once again connecting China with Central Asia, Europe, and the world. Before packing my bags for China, I caught up with Dr. Yu Jie, the China Research Fellow at London-based Policy Institute, Chatham House. I asked Dr. Yu to tell us more about the aims of the project. Just how big are China's ambitions?
Well, that's a very challenging question. So the Belt and Road Initiative, it is the brainchild for the Chinese President Xi Jinping to connect Chinese domestic politics, domestic economy, together with China's foreign policy. So the Belt and Road Initiative would cover 65% of the world GDP, and also including another 60% of all the world oil reserves already been discovered. So that's just to show you the sheer scale.
It is simply massive, and President Xi's ambition for the project seems endless. China has already spent around $200 billion on Belt and Road projects in more than 120 countries, accounting for two-thirds of the world's population. We're heading to Lanzhou in central China to focus on the local impact of this project. From a regional perspective, I wanted to know how cities get a piece of the Belt and Road action, and if there's much competition.
We have 32 provinces inside the country. And nowadays, almost every single province will try to claim its importance on this Belt and Road Initiative and their unique fit. And Lanzhou, especially the province of Gansu, has been struck as being a particular example of being very successful in doing that. The local government used the Belt and Road as a way of inviting foreign investments to cutting a bigger share of the budget from the central government as well. So strategically, they realize they have this historical link and therefore try to claim its own unique fit.
So what does the Belt and Road Initiative mean for the people on the ground? I went with Martin Yip, the BBC's bilingual reporter in Hong Kong, to a city at the heart of the project, Lanzhou.
Yeah.
Lanzhou, this is technically the center of China, also somebody would call it the beginning of the west of China, also the beginning of the old Silk Road. A bit further to Dunhuang, that's people would call it the beginning of Silk Road.
For me, I've never heard of Lanzhou. It's just massive, isn't it?
Yes, to me it's beef noodle. Everybody heard of Lanzhou beef noodle across China, even in Hong Kong, and they are such a renowned dish.
Are you going to get some tonight?
Well, definitely. I guess it's like the staple, right? You come to Lanzhou, you look for the beef noodle.
So it's located in western China on the Yellow River in a province called Gansu. There's been a lot of developments there in recent years, and it's positioned itself as a key transport and manufacturing hub for the new Silk Road.
Now I'm here and I took the train from the airport, which is literally something rare in China until recent years. You literally have a high-speed railway station or at least a local train station that you can take a relatively commuter-like train into the city. It's rare. Then you see those factories where you see all those chimneys burning, and then we're into a metropolis. You kick down the main road, you see all the skyscrapers.
Yeah, and it's a big, big difference, isn't it? Because there's skyscrapers that we see everywhere. And I believe that this is quite a melting pot as well, not just for Han Chinese, but for other ethnicities in China.
It should be pretty much the part where you start to see Muslims living here. And even I've just been talking about the train a lot. And the train did pass through a mosque or two.
It's a Muslim-majority city of 3 million residents, not just Uyghurs, but also Hui people. And of course, Han Chinese. It was around 2012 that they gave the go-ahead for a lot of developments here, and since then, large infrastructure projects like railways and airports have been built. Now the city of Lanzhou has begun to feel the effect. This PR professional knows more than I do. Zhou Yang himself grew up here and has personally witnessed the rapid change.
There's a joke that a lot of people from Lanzhou talk about. When they go out of Lanzhou to universities or college, many Chinese people from major cities would ask people from Lanzhou, "Oh, do you go to school riding camels?" So that's the that's the impression they have about Lanzhou. They thought Lanzhou is on a desert and people just ride camels everywhere. But actually, it's not true. But that's a reflection of the history of the city, because it was on the old Silk Road, which went all the way to Europe. And now there's this effort to sort of revive this old history because of China's Belt and Road Initiative. And the businesses have also jumping on the bandwagon to capitalize on the opportunity. I went to university in Beijing more than 10 years ago, so at that time I had to spend more than 24 hours on the train to go from Lanzhou to Beijing. But now we have this new high-speed rail link which only takes 8 hours. So that's a huge difference, and not only will that facilitate people-to-people exchange, cargo traffic will also be much easier.
More than any place in the province, the so-called Lanzhou New Area highlights the bold ambition of the Belt and Road. Here, you'll find numerous ambitious projects developed under the initiative, a mix of tourist destinations, manufacturing, and new business ventures. The land was deemed too steep to build on, so in order to construct this brand new city, more than 6,000 workers and 3,000 excavators were brought in to flatten hundreds of mountain tops. When it comes to the One Belt, One Road, they're literally willing to move mountains to make things happen. Now tourism draws thousands of people in from the surrounding area as the local government invests millions in various new attractions.
Even though we are thousands of miles from the coast, we arrive at the beach resort covered by a huge dome, an idyllic tropical scene complete with palm trees, white sand, and the sounds of gentle waves and children splashing about. To find out more, we caught up with the manager of the water park, Mr. Chen.
This water here comes from about 2,550 meters underground in the hot springs and emerges at around 40 degrees Celsius. And this is the biggest indoor structure in northwest China, and maybe the whole country.
So it's a real tropical zone, right?
It is indeed. He just explained to me that they have this heated floor and then air conditioning and, of course, the spring water. That's why we are feeling so much heat and humid.
And you've got your tissue out wiping your brow already.
I'm back in Hong Kong already.
It is that intensity. And
you will have thought that you are actually in somewhere beachside. And now we are in Gansu, right? There's no beaches here.
I know, we're right here and it feels like another world, really, from what's outside.
And now I think we're walking close to the spring area. 37 degrees, this pool is 37.
So I wondered if this huge artificial beach had been popular with tourists.
We have had more than 1 million visitors since 2017. Since President Xi brought in the One Belt, One Road initiative, Lanzhou has been in a great position. The Northwest helps Eastern China with resources, talented people, and transportation. An example of this is the Zhongshuan Airport, 5 kilometers away. There, we advertise our business, and this in turn attracts tourists to the water park. We have some tourists from Central Asia, but most of our customers come from the area around Lanzhou, as well as Shaanxi, Qinghai, Xinjiang, and Baiyin. Some visitors visit Lanzhou from the east and southeast regions of China.
Hoping to attract outsiders to this sparsely populated place, the local governments have opened cultural relic parks in the new area. In one, there's even life-size replicas of the Sphinx, and the Parthenon is an odd combination of historical trinkets and towering landmarks all thrown together, almost at random. On a tour of one such park, two guys showed me some of their prized possessions of days gone by.
Here we have a Taiping drum, a local instrument that was used during the ceremony for the 2008 Olympic Games. They're so large, they hang around the ankles. We also have a toy museum. These are from the 1980s, and you can find small clocks, chess, and pocket video games. And over here, a water pipe. These are only found in Lanzhou.
We've collected things to exhibit here from the 1950s and 60s. Back then, the sewing machine was one of the three core items that every modern house should have. We've collected many in our folklore museum.
I asked how the improved transport system has affected the number of visitors.
The introduction of the train has had a major influence on the area. Transportation has become more convenient, and this, in turn, has boosted visitors in Lanzhou. Here, our cultural businesses rely on tourism, and when the transportation improves, we all do well. Since last year, we've had big increases in our numbers, and in the last 12 months, welcomed 300,000 visitors. Before the opening of the high-speed railway, this could not have happened. A small number of the visitors were foreign, study tours from America mostly, but last year we saw a large increase in people coming from the eastern part of China.
Just tell me, Martin, so you pointed out a sign over there. What does that mean?
So that's the emblem of Chinese customs. So I presume this is where they will process all the paperwork for imports and exports. So we should be at the back of the airport right now.
This is like the centre hub of all the imports and exports because we've got not only the airport...
Ma Yufei takes the lead on showing me around the Lanzhou Free Trade Zone and tries to explain the way this tax-free no-man's land works.
The free trade zone is inside the country, but outside the tax area. If goods have been sent from Kazakhstan, for example, they're processed within this fence and treated as if they'd never entered the Chinese market. Then they're sent abroad and aren't taxed or charged customs fees. Lanzhou is located inland, We don't have coastal ports or share a border with other countries. The Belt and Road provides us with more opportunities to reach out to places in Central Europe and Asia. When people there opt to explore business through road and rail networks, we all become more productive.
So I asked Ma Yufei, what role has the Chinese government played in this?
Now that the state advocates for international trade, we definitely interact and collaborate more with countries along Belt and Road routes. On a personal level, you broaden your perspective when you have a platform to deal with international businesses directly. You have more chances to develop, and the same goes for the businesses. They're now able to look and reach out further. How should I put this? When we worked in the old way, we rarely got in touch with foreign companies or had exposure to international trading policies. And you have to pay attention to the latest international developments.
But who else is winning in this new Lanzhou? Wei Shepherd is the author of Ghost Cities of China and has spent over 6 years travelling the country.
The people who actually win in Lanzhou new area are, well, first of all, the government officials that built it, you know, and complied with national urbanization policies, who are in line to get promotions. It's the businesses that move in and take advantage of government subsidies to kind of move like manufacturing operations from, you know, a place like Shenzhen, or even now from like Chengdu, from the high tech zones there, up to kind of the new frontier, the new outpost of progress in China, where they can get, you know, free land, you know, tax-free, you know, manufacturing, where they can take advantage of this stuff. The winners are the logistics companies who now have, you know, a new advanced base camp where they can set up a new logistical hub and access Central Asia and Europe beyond, as well as northern and eastern China.
China wasn't always open for business. In the 1980s, Deng Xiaoping was the first leader to embrace the international community, with its open-door policies making China the factory of the world. In the 21st century, Xi Jinping's Belt and Road Initiative has built on this and its ambitions for a far-reaching global network. LS Group was one of the first organizations to move out of China at the start of the open-door era. As producers of drilling and refining equipment, they've been well-placed to take advantage of new routes to resource-rich countries in the West. Ran Wujing is the head of planning and development.
LS Group is China's largest production base for oil drilling, refining and chemical equipment. Where there are oil fields and refineries in China, you'll find our products. In the 1980s, we started to export. It was the earliest enterprise in China to participate in international exchange. The Belt and Road Initiative strategy has brought us more trade with foreign countries, and between 2017 and 2018, our export business grew by 183% and our import business by 103%. The countries along the Belt and Road route that have business relationships with us are mainly in Central Asian countries, Southeast Asia, and Russia. The Belt and Road Initiative has brought about a positive change. I think the Belt and Road Initiative is an opportunity for countries to jointly develop their economies. While the ultimate goal is for our own country or region to prosper, this can be achieved by working together.
Whilst businesses like LS Group have clearly benefited from the Belt and Road, other residents aren't quite so welcoming of the rapid change. Writer Wei Shepherd.
And the losers, when it comes to projects like Lanzhou New Area, are really the people that are kind of left behind, that are kind of left outside of this, you know, infrastructure and economic upheaval in the middle of the desert. These are, you know, minorities, the Huihui Muslim, the villagers that are kind of near the area that now all of a sudden have a new city, you know, in their backyard. It's the people, you know, minority groups that aren't really able to integrate within Han Chinese society and don't have the same opportunities that, you know, the Han Chinese investors and business people and people who are kind of from that cultural sphere have in Lanzhou. It's the undereducated kind of peasants that all of a sudden, now they've been moved into a city, they're kind of disoriented and don't really know how to make a living anymore. And also the losers are, you know, the local people who now have to compete with migrants coming from all over the country to compete for the construction jobs, to compete for even the white collar, you know, IT jobs, to compete for all these new opportunities that are being created. And people who are kind of educated, you know, in China's East have these natural advantages over, quote unquote, the bumpkins that live out in the middle of Gansu province.
Today, more and more students from countries on the Belt and Road map are choosing to study in China, taking advantage of scholarship programs strongly connected to the Belt and Road Initiative. As they settle in, these new residents bring with them new food, languages, and of course, religion. Aisha runs a local coffee shop and meets new faces all the time.
There's very many people from Pakistan, so like Egypt, in Lanzhou University. Most residents here is Muslim, so here are many people from the Middle East. They're studying here, and some people work here. They may be married to a Chinese girl. They all try to learn Chinese, and we also have some translators here in the mosque. Maybe at first people will feel curious for the foreigners, but now I think it's really a normal thing to see a foreigner on the street. I met a girl who's from Pakistan, but she feels really difficult to adapt to the food and the climate. But most people from Egypt, they really like here. I don't know why.
I went on to ask Aisha if she had to guess. Why does she think these foreign students come here?
Maybe I think it's because of religions. Because they can find the mosques here and they can find some Chinese Muslims here. So they're really easy to make friends with them. Most of them I meet, they really feel it's not like that good in big cities like Beijing or Shanghai. But here is really slow pace, so they really feel maybe in this way is comfortable, and the education in Lanzhou University is really good. Yeah.
Lanzhou is now at a cultural crossroads. In this newly opened bookshop, I can see people not just browsing the bookshelves around the whole area, but also enjoying a sip of coffee, which might not have been that common in this part of China before. I asked one customer, Chen Defeng, what she thought about the Belt and Road.
对于我来讲，一带一路这几天，我也一直关注那个第二届一带一路的这个大会。
I think the Belt and Road Initiative is a good project and a positive contribution by China to the world. It represents the concept of a shared future for mankind. As a Chinese person, I take pride in my country, and Chinese people are enjoying economic prosperity. We influence ourselves, as well as our partners, the countries along the new Silk Road map.
哎，就是在一带一路沿线的国家，可能到欧洲啊会比我们国家好一点，但是大家。European
countries might be doing better than us in some areas, but we need communication and interaction with each other to grow. During the recent Belt and Road Forum, there were seminars for different industries. I work in social care for disabled people. And there was a seminar which gathered relevant NGOs of Belt and Road countries. A good number of NGOs attended the forum, and within the Belt and Road Initiative, China gave their partners some opportunities. As a result of this, we Chinese have some opportunities as well. It's about more than making money. We're not just going out there to do business. Young people like me have a cause. and a dream. We want opportunities to visit other countries and do something meaningful. China is not condescending to others by offering sympathy and help. This is genuine equality. We open our arms and offer opportunities to others who give us opportunities in return.
Indeed, many of the people I've spoken to seem to think the change has been a positive one. But for how long? Lu Jie of Chatham House.
The issues with the Belt and Road Initiative, the issues arise often is, on the one hand, do we see the real economic benefit? But then on the other hand, the Chinese companies, who are mostly state-owned enterprises, they're looking to fulfill a political task to show their loyalty, to show their support to President Xi himself. So inevitably, certain projects become a white elephant projects. In the past 5 years, we seems did not really considering so much about how much economic return China should have. And what we're really concerned is how much political influence China was trying to extend.
Finally, I wanted to know why Dr. Yu Jie thinks that China seems so intent on becoming more powerful on the world stage.
Look at the geopolitical situation China is facing. China shared borders with 17 different countries. And China has issues with 15 different countries which China shared a border with. You know, only two of them do not really have any problems at all. One of the essence for the Chinese foreign policy is to create a very stable external environment in order to facilitate domestic economic development. So the Belt and Road is a direct application to that essence of the Chinese foreign policy. And that's why the controversies around the Belt and Road Initiative have arisen again and again.
You've been listening to Stories from the New Silk Road. I'm Peter Shevlin, and this episode of The Compass was presented by Martin Yip and was a Block Media production for the BBC World Service.
Death in Ice Valley is back.
She was laying with her head down there.
Fake passports, the wigs, the unprescripted glasses.
There are somebody living who knows more about this case.
I'm Marja Tigroff.
And I'm Neil McCarthy.
And we've been trying to find answers to an unsolved mystery.
Why all this secrecy?
It was like a cover-up.
Now, 1 year on, we're back with an update on the case.
Yes, with new leads to follow from you, our listeners.
This is maybe the first lead of evidence we have in almost 48 years.
More on the original investigation.
They were being told, don't work it anymore, or don't go into that.
And maybe even a brand new eyewitness.
I feel I met this lady. That's a special episode of Death in Ice Valley, recorded live in Bergen in Norway, from the BBC World Service and NRK.
Catch up with the whole series now, and you'll also find our new episode.
Just search for Death in Ice Valley, wherever you get your podcasts.